My name's Andy Caffrey. I've been a community activist and a bookstore manager and worked in a number of different fields. But I basically had to focus my life on doing activism because the situation with the environment and the collapse of our economy, and I believe the Republicans are dismantling our democracy, it now requires me to do this. It requires me to go to Washington, D.C. and raise hell. I live in Garberville, California, which is in Humboldt County, 200 miles north of San Francisco.
Obviously, you're seeking office because you feel the North State can be better represented. Can you explain three key policy areas where you think you'd be more in step with local voters than incumbent Jared Huffman?
We're now living in a time of crisis. Unlike most politicians, my politics comes out of assessing true reality, such as how bad is the climate crisis? How much do we have to reduce our fossil fuels, or what else will happen? My biggest issue, and the thing that is most unique about me, is that 20 years ago, I became very concerned about the collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet from global warming and the threat of 20 feet of sea level rise. In 1998, I had written an article in the Earth Island Journal warning about another madhouse century. The madhouse century occurred 120,000 years ago. Sea level suddenly jumped up from where it is now, about 20 feet, and then it turned around and went down 50 feet all in one century. That's an 8-inch per year net change. And in 1995, I'd seen that a giant iceberg the size of Rhode Island had broken off of the West Antarctic ice sheet. So I was looking into, is this a potential threat? Well, not only is it a threat, in 2009, Nature published a story talking about something like this had happened also a million years ago, and that the water that caused sea level rise came from West Antarctica. So now we're in a situation where NASA in 2014 announced that the collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet and 20 feet of sea level rise is unstoppable. Unstoppable. It means that the climate denialists who have been in power for 38 years denying that global warming is real have sabotaged our national security, and 132 nations are going to see 20 feet of sea level rise in this century. To me, this is an act of war. And so what it means is we actually need an electoral revolution to oust these, what I call petrocrats and militarists and banksters from Congress, and we need a herd of citizen leaders to get into Congress. So what does it mean to have 20 feet of sea level rise coming sometime this century, something that's not of immediate concern to people? Well, we have a lot of problems in our society. If we're going to become sustainable, we don't want to build our sustainability on the coast when it's going to be flooded. And my biggest concern now is that we have all these nuclear power plants, and in the U.S. it takes 60 years to decommission them, but they're sitting about 5 feet above sea level, so they're due to be flooded in 30 years or so. So my plan is called Environomics, and I also have an agenda called New Green America, which is a way of reducing this threat by getting us off fossil fuels in 10 years or less, and that requires a infrastructure project to rebuild our infrastructure so that we don't need fossil fuels in 10 years. So that means we're going to have to cut back on our military and the war on drugs and restore very high tax rates on the richest Americans, take that money from the federal government and send it down to the counties and the states so that they can plan how to build their infrastructure in a way that doesn't require fossil fuels. So I've signed on to the Contract for American Renewal. It's a candidate's contract with the members of his or her district to introduce within their first 6 months in office legislation for a $15 minimum wage, infrastructure development, taxing the elites, taking bold action on climate destabilization, ending the war in Afghanistan, expanding Social Security and Medicare to provide high-quality health care for everybody, ending corporate personhood and reversing Citizens United, free college tuition at public colleges and universities, and reversing globalist trade agreements. So essentially, we're going to have this national emergency effort like we had in response to World War II. At that time, we decided we weren't even going to make cars for 3 years. So what we need to do is we need to make sure everyone is taken care of during this transition, because if we want to get off fossil fuels, it's going to do a lot to destabilize the whole global economy, and we already have a very difficult time with jobs and incomes in our country. 63% of Americans don't have more than $500 in case of an emergency. So my campaign is largely about taking on the climate crisis head on, getting rid of the people who put us in this situation, and building a society that takes care of everybody and makes everybody secure.
Illegal immigration and cannabis seem to have joined abortion and firearms as wedge issues in a supposed culture war across the nation. Where do you stand on each of those issues, and how much latitude should states have to set their own rules?
It's been a real betrayal that Republicans have divided the nation around wedge issues when we have so much we have to take care of together. Team America. Issues like guns, illegal immigration, abortion. People will vote for those things, and then they'll vote against every other interest they have, either economically or ecologically or in terms of making their communities better. I'm a pro-choice person, so I will always be supporting the rights of a woman to choose. I look at the immigration issue from two different directions. I look at it from what is the cause of people to come to this country, and much of that is the neoliberal banking system that we've imposed upon those nations. Many people don't know, but I've worked since the 1980s against U.S. wars in Central America, Nicaragua and El Salvador and Guatemala and Honduras. And most of the immigrants coming into our country illegally now are from those countries, not from Mexico, because we supported these terrible dictators who tore apart those countries. And we set up banking policies where subsistence agriculture is very rarely practiced because they're all now on the market system. So they used to be able to take care of their needs in these countries and in Mexico, but our banking system destroyed their ability to do that. So I think we have to deal with things on that end. On the other hand, I grew up in Los Angeles and went to college in San Diego. So I also understand the impacts on our communities here in the United States in the border regions, and that's no joke. It really does have an impact. So we have to deal with that too. So what I've done is my climate plan helps the situation. If we are going to get off fossil fuels in 10 years or less, it doesn't help if the rest of the world keeps burning them. So we have to also help a lot of these third world countries that we've historically milked for their labor and their resources do the same thing. So I believe that what we need to do is with the profits from oil companies and other industries, agricultural companies, fast food companies that have, I was very involved in stopping rainforest beef from being purchased by Burger King in the 1980s. These kinds of things, we have to pay these people back. We destroyed their infrastructure, so we have to fix it. It's like Iraq. We destroyed their country, and we have an obligation to fix it. We destroyed it for a lie. So I believe that we need to have this global sustainability project, and when people in those countries find that they can make a living and have nice communities where they're living, they're not going to want to come here. If they come here, they'll do it a legitimate way. So I think we can fix the immigration problem, and in the last 6 or 7 years, there's been overall a reversal. We've had more of these people leaving the country than coming in. So it's not even that big of an issue at this point. Regarding guns, I'm about to prepare a second contract for American Renewal that's a contract that I'm making with the Republicans in our district. And one of the things I will have on there are things that I will and won't do. It will have that I, no matter what they want me to do, I will support a woman's right to choose to have an abortion if that's what she and her doctor want her to do. But I'm not going to come after people's guns. I do feel that a few things need to be changed, like bump stocks and perhaps high-capacity magazines. And I do think that we should get off of this culture that aggrandizes semi-automatic rifles. But I'm also aware that semi-automatic rifles aren't killing that many people. That's not the reason why 30,000 people are dying from guns. I guess about 10,000 of those are from murders. So we need to look at this in a realistic way, and so I'm basically going to promise the people in our district that whenever there's any gun legislation, I'm going to come back to the district and spend a lot of time listening to what everybody has to say about it. And then we've got cannabis. Well, I happen to live in the cannabis-growing capital of the world. In California's 2nd District, 3 of our 6 counties are called the Emerald Triangle, And I moved up here from the Bay Area in the late 80s. I moved up here to save I came up here to save the redwoods, not to smoke marijuana, but I live in a culture where $2.4 billion a year comes in from marijuana. It's the most dominant income source for Humboldt County, and I think probably for Mendocino and Trinity as well. So this is a cultural change that's occurring in our nation. And in 2012, when I first ran for Congress, President Obama was coming into the North Coast with his teams to shut down our dispensaries. So two of my fellow candidates from the northern region of the district, John Llewellyn and Dr. William Courtney and I, we had a protest in front of one of the closed dispensaries, and at that protest, I smoked a joint. And that was I'd done direct action work in Earth First, and so I wanted to do a direct action to legalize marijuana because I don't believe anybody should spend any time in jail for cannabis. We have millions of people whose lives have been destroyed. And think about it. If you have a mom-pop farmer and they both get thrown in jail for growing pot, what's it like for their kids growing up without their parents? It's just ridiculous. In my district, we had a doctor who had been here for 23 years, and just before he moved out of the area, I asked him, you know what marijuana does to people's health. You've been here for 23 years, and there's probably no higher concentration of marijuana smokers than there is here. What are the real health effects of smoking marijuana? And he said, well, I've had two people who smoked about 20 joints a day who had esophageal bleeding. Other than that, he was concerned about kids between 15 and 18 smoking pot. Other than that, nothing. And so it's just been this thing that was used to arrest hippies in the 60s. You got these radicals, and you can't arrest them for free speech. Let's go in. They all smoke pot. Let's go in and arrest them. And there's a whole big history of the persecution of the marijuana industry. Well, apparently President Obama was watching, because I got on MSNBC twice because of this action, and I called him out. I said, people really suffer when he comes in here and shuts down our dispensaries. No one should spend another hour in jail for smoking pot, and a lot of people, especially veterans, have to hide the fact that they need to do this from all of their friends or they lose their benefits. And so no one should feel shame because they have to take cannabis as their medicine. And about 6 months later, the Washington and Colorado initiatives passed, and then about 4 months later, 3 months later, President Obama suddenly reversed course and said that he was not going to be coming into the states that had legalized marijuana one way or another. And then a couple months later, he said that he was going to end mandatory minimum sentences for marijuana-related crimes. And about a month later, he said he was going to offer clemency procedures so that people who have already been sentenced harshly for marijuana violations can apply to be resentenced at the current guidelines. So I feel it's very important to stand up for our rights. I'm also very concerned as an ecologist about the negative impacts of trespass grows, a lot of indoor grows, and using a lot of water diversion to grow marijuana. So we have to ecologize it. And the only way to do all of these things is to bring it out in the open. So I'm really thrilled that I made some kind of contribution to liberalizing these laws. And now we have to figure out what is the right way to do it. What's the right way to keep mom-pop farmers, you know, in business? And how do we do it in a way that's not going to be as destructive to my ecosystem here on the coast as the logging was? I just recently saw a film about the history of our river, and I'm one of the people in the film, and after the part about fighting for Headwaters Forest, the Redwood Forest I fought, they had a whole section on what's happened with marijuana, and they had these satellite photographs of our region, and boy, the clear cuts for marijuana grows look just like the clear cuts for logging. So, you know, it's hypocritical for environmentalists to say the clear-cutting of the ancient forest is bad, but it's perfectly fine to destroy the forest by creating marijuana patches.
All right. The North State differs from the rest of California in many ways. What is the most critical challenge the North State faces, and how would you help address that challenge?
Well, most people don't know it, but the most critical plight we have is sea level rise. There's a National Geographic film called Earth Underwater. I encourage people to see it. And they interview a UC Berkeley or UC Davis professor who talks about how the first 6 feet of sea level rise is going to destroy the Central Valley water supply for 26 million Californians. And in that, they propose building a dam across the Golden Gate Bridge. Can you believe that? A dam across the Golden Gate Bridge. And it's going to cost $2.5 billion. And there's a similar situation at the Straits of Gibraltar. It's a $25 billion dam that they propose there. And so, you know, what's going to happen? Obviously, we're going to have to build that dam, or else we're going to lose the whole Bay Area, all the communities that live around the Bay Area, and we're going to lose our water supply. This is absolutely crazy. This is stunningly stupid. And this is really immoral, what's been done by these climate denialists who got us to this point. So the main thing is that we all have to focus on this issue and get rid of those people who put us in this situation. And so we have to have this electoral revolution to oust these people. That is the most critical thing anybody can be working on right now. We've got to stop these people who have come close to destroying our planet. The sea level rise, it's going to take out 80 of the 100 biggest cities in the world before 2100. This is a world that's for real. Most people, because they don't hear other people talking about it, want to pretend that it's not happening. Oh, if Andy's the only guy talking about it, it can't be real. Well, in 2014, in 2014, NASA came out saying that the collapse was unstoppable. 2015, Dr. James Hansen's team said we're going to see 50 feet, I'm sorry. In 2015, Dr. James Hansen's team said we're going to see 10 feet of sea level rise over the next 50 years. In 2006, NOAA gave a presentation to 20,000 insurance industry risk assessors and said we're going to see 9 feet of sea level rise by 2050. Last year, the state of California came out with a report warning of 10 feet of sea level rise over the next 70 years. And just this week, we got a new one here in Humboldt County that says we're going to have 15 feet of sea level rise by 2100. This is for real, and nobody's dealing with it. So that's the big thing. Getting people to focus on this, getting the right politicians elected, and then building a new infrastructure and taking care of people and getting these nuclear power plants and toxic sites removed from our coastlines before it's too late.
Our region is the source of much of the state's water supply. Do you think that there's anything wrong with the current system? And what is your stance on current water infrastructure proposals, such as raising the height of Shasta Dam, building a site's reservoir, and the Delta bypass tunnels?
Most of our politicians and state planners are not seriously addressing the fact that we're going to have this massive sea level rise. And so they're coming up with all kinds of crazy infrastructure projects as if nothing's going to change. We've been overusing water for ages. George Carlin has done a good riff on how much water is used by golf courses. He thinks golf courses should be illegal. And I agree with him. You know, look at Las Vegas. How ridiculous. We're using all that water in the desert. What humans have to do now is we have to fit into our ecosystem. And the way I advocate it is for us to design infrastructure around the ecozones, and these are called bioregions. And a bioregion is a type of ecosystem, and what you can do is then assess how much can you change this ecosystem and not destroy it. So how much logging can you do, and in the long term, not destroy the forest? Or how much agriculture can you do in an area and not deplete the soils? So we have to do an assessment where we figure out how to get down to no fossil fuels, but we also have to look at how we use water. And we can meet our water needs as citizens, as people who live in communities, but we can't use water for things that aren't really important. We're going to have to just change that. We've made changes before. When I was a boy, almost all of my parents' friends smoked cigarettes. They'd come over to our house for a party and hang out, and they'd all be smoking cigarettes inside. That's not the way it is anymore. None of my friends who are close to my age smoke tobacco anymore. So we have to do this thing. I know it's hard. You know, our monkey brains are designed to deal with short-term emergencies. Oh, you know, look at that rhino that's coming towards us. Or look at the fire on the hillside. Let's get out of here. Or this storm is destroying our shelter. We've got to fix it. But dealing with things like cycles of ice ages and ice sheets collapsing and being built up, that's not something we normally think about. So that's why it requires someone like me and a lot more people to be out there reminding us all the time. Just like with these wedge issues that you brought up earlier, people can vote on abortion and then vote to destroy the planet. That just doesn't make sense. And so we have to start to talk about these major issues, and that means maybe putting down our smartphone and not watching as much TV. If you are losing your job, maybe you have some more time to do some activism and work for some candidates. But, you know, things are changed now. We have to look at things differently, and we have to look down at our kids and say, hey, I'm going to do what it takes to make sure you are in a beautiful, livable world.
Homelessness has become an entrenched problem for most communities, but remedies are elusive. What effective measures might be taken at the federal level to end homelessness?
I recently heard on the Jimmy Dore show that for $20 billion we could end homelessness. Well, what we found in many areas, there are all kinds of pet projects to actually pay for the housing for all the homeless people in various cities. And what they find is that if they do that, they reduce a lot of the other expenses they have, like policing them, jailing them, dealing with them in emergency rooms. And plus, in my area, I've been working with homeless people for about 10 years. And what I've found is you basically want people to be as well and as balanced and as safe as possible for them to be their best self. It's really fundamental. And so a lot of problems in our neighborhood, and it is a very contentious issue here in my little town of 2,000 people in Garberville. A lot of people just want to push it away. They just want to push it away. And I feel it's time to have a new American slogan. Our original one was E Pluribus Unum, out of the many one. And then during the Cold War, we came up with In God We Trust. Well, I think we need a new one. We're Americans. We take care of each other. And so I feel that what we have to do is, with this broader social safety net that I'm talking about for us as we go through this reconstruction of our economy and all of the economic dislocation, we got to make sure everyone can stay in their house. We got to make sure that the people who aren't in houses now and want housing have some kind of housing. And there are all kinds of ways of doing that, from tiny houses to using closed down schools to make apartment complexes, many, many things that can be done. And we actually don't have to spend that much money. The reason I think it's only $20 billion to take care of everybody in the country who's homeless is because you do have a reduction in other costs when you take people out of homelessness. Around here, I had always been sort of focused on the bigger issues like the environment and war and peace and the national economy. But about 10 years ago, I think this thing called the grandpa gene, or I call it the grandpa gene, kicked in me. I don't have any kids. But I suddenly started to feel this compassion for individuals. And I went through the Oakland firestorm in 1991 and got PTSD. And then I became homeless for 5 years. And I would probably still be homeless if another friend of mine, an activist friend of mine that I'd worked with, hadn't died. And this record company wanted to make a compact disc of her best speeches. And so I had shot all these videos of her, and my work on that project got me out of my homelessness. So having PTSD, I was going to this community lunch, and I was hanging out with a veteran who had PTSD, and he was sleeping in a tent, and it had been just raining all the time for about a week, and he was going nuts. He was about to commit suicide, and at one point later on, he rode his bike into traffic, but he didn't get hit, and he's still alive. He's actually in veteran housing out in Klamath Falls, Oregon right now. But when I saw his suffering, I this empathy that I'd never had before just swelled up in my chest. And so that fall, we had 3 homeless people die in our community. 2 of them were veterans. And, you know, they were in bad, bad shape. You know, they've been drinking and doing drugs for a long time, and they were just a complete mess. They were just in a very a situation you wouldn't wish on your worst enemy. And so we found we couldn't have a kind of shelter because the Veterans Hall wouldn't let us do it anymore because there was concern about antibiotic-resistant staph infections, and they thought that if they let the Veterans Hall be used for an overnight shelter, that the people who rent it during the day wouldn't want to do that. And so we were stuck, and that's why we lost those three people. So I started using our community radio station. We have a Friday morning talk show called Thank Josh Friday, and there's a couple of anarchists who have a bookstore here. They're in their 70s, and they were the ones who were basically the only ones doing support for homeless people. And people would bring food there and buy tarps and sleeping bags and coats and socks and things. And so what I would do is I'd go over and hang out with these friends and find out what the homeless people needed that week, and then I'd call up Thank Josh Friday and say, okay, well, this week what we really need is socks. Well, I would also tell a little story about homeless people I knew. This one guy, Jack, was walking around in the snow, and he had no gloves on and no hat, and he just had a T-shirt on, just kind of in a daze. And from telling these stories, apparently it awakened a compassion in the listeners. We had been having a big feud in our community, and I had people come up saying, wow, it was so great to hear this compassionate energy you've got. And so this marijuana grower came to a church and peeled off $1,000 in 20s one day, and we rented a office, and I organized and ran a homeless shelter for 6 weeks, and we saved three people's lives there. So it's the point of all of this is, in dealing with forests, trying to preserve them, and dealing with something like homelessness, it changes yourself as an activist, because if you don't do something in time, you see the consequences. If you don't get someone sheltered in time, they die. If the loggers are going to come in on Thursday, you better stop them by Thursday or the forest is gone. So we really have to make this a priority. We should leave no one behind. Like I said, we're Americans. We take care of each other. And the thing is, you know, I see all these people complaining about, like the Trump supporters complaining about Muslims and illegal immigrants and homeless people and whatever. And a lot of the things that actually impact them wouldn't be impacting them if we took care of these people. You know, we don't have to arrest everyone that comes into this country. We just have to stop destroying their country. So we have to get rid of the politicians who have supported these kinds of banking situations that have destroyed these countries. So one of the things I tell people if they're concerned and upset about homelessness, well, if you don't want homelessness, stop voting Republican. It's their austerity. It was Ronald Reagan who unleashed a whole bunch of mentally ill people onto our streets. So, you know, if people just, they've been told a bunch of nonsense for so long that we're all in this, I don't know, emotional social swamp. And it's very distressing. I happen to get along really well with Republicans, independents. You know, I have friends who are pot growers and friends who tell me that God talks to them. There is a way for us to be in communities and not be divided. And so I'm trying to provide some guidance for how we can move forward practically, but in a way that takes care of us all, you know? It's what I grew up thinking America was about. You know, father knows best, my three sons, that kind of thing, leave it to Beaver. You know, we want everybody to be taken care of and go to good schools and have ambitions for their life and want to be a team player with the other people in their community and have a good laugh, you know? So I think we can do that, and that's why I'm running for Congress.
Congress is entrusted with the power of the purse, budgeting and spending public money. What policy areas and programs do you think deserve more money, and what would be the source of that money?
I believe we should use our tax system to put taxes on the things we want to discourage and give subsidies or at least tax breaks on the things we want to encourage. So, for example, we have this marijuana economy that's coming, and I think we should be giving tax breaks to the people who will do it ecologically and on a small scale. I think we have to have things like carbon taxes, but the problem with carbon taxes is that a lot of poor people who have to use their car to get to their job are going to be paying more taxes. So we also have to subsidize them, have gas stamps, sort of like food stamps for a lot of people. And we have to build, my idea is that we have to have a transportation infrastructure that's free, that works really well, so that when people find that the cost of having their own car and running it is too much, they'll have a good alternative that they can just step into. So, for example, where I live in my town of 2000, the nearest big town, and really the only big one in our county, is about 30,000 people. And it's 65 miles away, and it has a movie theaters and nice restaurants and all of that. So if you wanted to go up to go to have a nice dinner and go to a movie on a Friday or Saturday night, you're out of luck, because the buses only run Monday through Friday, and they stop around 7 o'clock at night. And that's why a lot of people just think buses don't work. Well, if we had 24-hour buses, and the buses went to where people went, and then people found the gas prices were going up too much. I remember about, I don't know, I guess maybe 10, 20 years ago, I heard that it was something like $5,000 for the average American to have and run a car. That's a lot of money. So if you can say, look, you can do that. You know, we're not going to come and take your car away. But here's this free public transportation system. So if you decide you want to spend that $5,000 or $6,000 or $7,000, whatever it would be now, on something else, I don't know, maybe fixing up your place, you can use these alternative transportation systems we have. We can also, you know, we can always rent cars. And there's a lot of people who are in the industry who are talking about basically everyone leasing their cars, and then after a few years, you turn it back in, and it's dismantled, and you get a newer, better model. So I do think there are ways of dealing with this. I'm not going to impose that, though, on anybody. I think the communities have to decide the kind of infrastructure they want to have. But I think we do have to have this expanded social safety net. It does include giving people free transportation, and I'm not in favor of taking away anybody's cars. But you have to look at why, you know, how do we determine what's too much CO2 in the atmosphere? Well, you do have to look at really, really old history. In fact, you have to look at the last 2.5 million years. This era called the Pleistocene that we've been living in is an era of oscillating into and out of ice ages. And we have ecosystems that have evolved in those conditions. So they have tolerances today that they wouldn't have had 2.5 million years ago, because they evolved through these kinds of stresses. What you have is a situation where you look at what are the natural variations that have occurred that our ecosystems have evolved through. And we now know that in the last 2.5 million years, our atmospheric CO2, the natural range, has been between 170 parts per million and 290 parts per million. We're now over 410 parts per million. When I was in high school, I studied marine biology, and we'd go out and study tide pools, and every hour we would measure the temperature, salinity, and pH of the tide pools, and then we'd wade out into the ocean and do the same thing there. And what you find is the creatures in the tide pool have to experience an increase in the temperature of the water, because as the tide retreats and the sun passes overhead, those little pools become isolated, and so they warm up. That causes evaporation, and less water to salt means it's going to be saltier. So the creatures that live in the tide pools evolve to those tolerances. Out in the ocean, you have hardly any change at all in the course of the day, because when the sun beats down at noon, it's absorbed by the whole global ocean. And so the creatures out there don't develop very much of a tolerance. And in terms of temperature, that they're called stenothermal. Steno means narrow. And the creatures in the tide pool are called eurythermal. They have a wide tolerance. So what we have to do to figure out how much is too much is look at what are the natural limits that our ecosystems have been through. And so I believe that the highest it was before the last 2.5 million years was 290 parts per million. So we have to get back down to there. And that's why I make the case that if we don't want to further destabilize our climate systems, we have to have this national emergency effort to get off fossil fuels and get back down to 290 parts per million.
Environmental activist, community organizer, and Democratic candidate for California's 2nd Congressional District, Andy Caffrey, thank you so much.
My pleasure.